PR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York's child care assistance program is on hold, putting Sullivan County parents and daycare providers in a tough spot. Isabel Braverman, editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, joins us live to explain the pause and its impact on local families. After February's correctional officers' strike in New York, families say they face the same indignities their loved ones do inside. Their story's coming up from reporter Julia Kim. Books aren't just stories, they're artifacts worth preserving. This week, the Livingston Manor Library hosting a hands-on program on book conservation. Get a preview and how to do it from a professional book conservator. And culture reporter Valerie Manzi with artist Bonnie Richlack's newest exhibit at Catskill Art Space. All coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Later this hour, two lawmakers will hold a press conference on Capitol Hill. Republican Thomas Massie and Democrat Ro Khanna will be joined by survivors of sexual abuse by late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The congressmen are trying to use a procedural tool in the House to force the release of documents from the Epstein investigation. Some Republican leaders say they do not want the full files to be shared in order to protect the women who were involved. Some of the survivors plan to speak at the Capitol today. One of them is podcaster Lisa Phillips. She says survivors need full disclosure.
We're already being harmed because there's no accountability. There's no transparency. That's what harms us, is that the people that need to be held accountable aren't.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. A panel of the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has blocked the Trump administration from using a wartime power to deport Venezuelans from three states. As NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports, that means the issue of President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act could wind up back at the U.S. Supreme Court.
The latest court decision blocks deportations with the use of the act from Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Earlier this year, Trump invoked the 18th century wartime power to help streamline deportations of Venezuelans he says are members of the Tren de Aragua gang. Since then, the use of this power has attracted numerous legal challenges, including two prior Supreme Court decisions. But the high court has yet to directly address the larger question of whether Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act at all was legal. This preliminary injunction can now be appealed by the Trump administration to settle that bigger question. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
Staffers at the Department of Health and Human Services have sent an open letter to Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Congress. 1,000 agency workers are calling on him to resign. The letter says Kennedy has put the health of all Americans at risk. The workers say they've already urged him to stop spreading inaccurate health information. Stocks open mixed this morning as Kraft Heinz prepares for a breakup and Google does not. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 160 points in early trading.
Stock in Kraft Heinz rose after the company announced plans to split in two. The corporate breakup comes a decade after Kraft and Heinz merged in an effort to capitalize on their massive scale. But sales have fallen in each of the last 5 years amid shifting consumer tastes. A federal judge in San Francisco stopped short of ordering a breakup of Google and its Chrome browser. The judge did impose new restrictions on the search giant in an effort to prevent Google from abusing its monopoly power. McDonald's is rolling out new discounts on combo meals next week in an effort to win back some of its most price-sensitive customers. The fast food industry overall has seen a drop in business from lower-income diners. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The mayor of Baltimore says he does not want the National Guard deployed in his city. President Trump says he is ready to send federal authorities there to combat crime. Trump already deployed the Guard in Los Angeles and Washington and federalized D.C.'s police force. NPR's Kristen Wright has more.
Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott says rates of homicide and non-fatal shootings in the city are at historic lows. He told local TV station WJZ there are better ways for the federal government to help Baltimore further reduce crime.
We want to keep that work going, but we do not need or want the National Guard in Baltimore to do that. The best way for us to continue this progress or help us continue this progress that we are already making is to restore the funding for public safety programs that the president cut. pass a federal ban on ghost guns and Glock switches.
Scott, a Democrat, is also calling for the repeal of laws limiting the disclosure of firearms records. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says he also plans to send National Guard troops to Chicago. A federal judge in Texas is going to hear arguments today in a case involving aircraft maker Boeing. The Justice Department is seeking to drop conspiracy charges against Boeing. This is in connection with two huge plane crashes of its 737 MAX jetliner. 346 people were killed, one in an accident off Indonesia, another in Ethiopia. Relatives of the victims are trying to stop the Justice Department from dropping the charges. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance, from filing returns to tracking assessments. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Since July, Sullivan County families have been facing uncertainty after officials announced a pause on enrollment and recertification for the state's child care assistance program due to a lack of funding from the state's budget. Parents and providers are questioning how long support will be on hold and what it means for working families who depend on affordable child care. Joining us now, Isabel Braverman, editor of the Sullivan County Democrat, who's been reporting on this story. Isabel, welcome.
Hi.
Let's talk about what the Child Care Assistance Program does in New York. It's CCAP or CCAP abbreviated. What does that do in the state for folks and low-income families?
Right. So it provides funding for low-income families to help pay for child care. And that means either a daycare or other, you know, certified provider. And the funding helps to pay for either a partial cost or the total cost of daycare for these families. And it's a statewide program, but it's issued through each county in the state.
And it's since July 1st, Sullivan County, like other counties, had to pause enrollment. And why is that?
Right. So the state provided funding for the CCAP program, but they expanded the qualifications in order, you know, for families to be eligible to enroll. So a lot more people enrolled in the program, and the funding ran out. It couldn't keep up with the demands. And so now Sullivan County and other counties are facing a shortage in funding from the state, so they cannot continue to enroll people into the program.
And in your article in the Sullivan County Democrat, we mentioned other counties. There are reported 21 other counties currently not accepting applicants. And you also mentioned there was this expansion of CCAP. What did you hear from Commissioner of Health and Human Services John Little about the expansion and the pause?
Right. So he, you know, commended the expansion because it allows more families to be able to afford daycare or other, you know, child care programs. And that is something that, you know, daycares have been struggling with, being able to keep up with the costs of it. So having more people able to enroll is helping the daycares. So it's sort of helping, you know, both the families and the daycares all around. But he said that their predicted numbers for the amount of children who would be eligible for this funding exceeded their predictions by a lot. And because of the lack of funding coming in from the state budget, they have had to have this pause since July 1st.
And as we mentioned, the program, CCAP, is administered at the local level, but it's overseen at the state level by the State Office of Children and Family Services, or OCFS. What did OCFS have to say about the state investment in child care and this program?
Yeah, so they also commended Governor Kathy Hochul for expanding this program. They said it allowed 170,000 children statewide to be able to receive this funding. In terms of the pause going on right now, they did say that they were able to release a little bit more funding to counties, including an additional $250,000 to Sullivan County. But Commissioner Little says that they expect to use that share of the additional funding before the end of September. So clearly, you know, that will run out fairly quickly.
So because they think it's going to run out before the end of September, they can't recertify applicants or take new ones at right now.
Right. That is correct. So the pause will continue.
And what are the numbers we're talking about here compared to this year versus last year?
Yeah. So the Sullivan County Child Care Council said that in June of last year, there were 583 children enrolled in CCAP. And in June of this year, there were 1,344. So as you can see, that is quite a jump in numbers.
Doubled, yeah, more than doubled. What are the folks at the Child Care Council and others saying about the impact on families?
Yeah, so they're hearing from quite a few families. You know, they didn't have a number of how many exactly, but they said it was a few who have decided to pull their children out of daycare. And to leave their jobs to care for their children at home because they, without the funding, they can't afford the daycare programs.
This also has a negative effect on children, too.
Right, yeah. I talked to Jessica Dean, who owns a daycare in Monticello, and she spoke a lot about this negative impact when there's an interruption in care because young children really thrive on routine and having, you know, a safe place to go every day so that their parents can go to work. She also mentioned that it is especially, has a big effect on children with special needs.
She also is quoted in your article as saying, quote, "There is a widespread ripple. All of this affects our community as a whole. If people leave their jobs, less people in the workforce, less tax dollars. It's affecting child care programs. I know one provider who lost 10 kids in 2 weeks in Orange County," end quote. That's from Jessica Dean, owner of Jessica's Daycare in Monticello. She's also advocating for reopening CCAP. What is she doing to try to push folks at the officials in the county and at the state level to reopen CCAP?
Yeah, so she's been in contact with State Assembly Member Paula Kay and our Congressman Josh Riley. She said she's really been advocating with them to reopen the funding for CCAP. She's also been in touch with John Little, the county commissioner, as well. So she is hopeful that they can, you know, get something going to resolve this issue.
Is there any timeline at all that anyone's indicating here, or we're still just waiting and it's on pause?
From what I've heard, both from Jessica and John Little, it's going to be a while, at least a few months.
Wow. That's editor-in-chief of the Sullivan County Democrat, Isabel Braverman, reporting on deficits in funding from New York State impacting child care. They have had to pause the New York State Child Care Assistance Program that provides money for low-income families to help pay for child care, reimbursing either the total cost or partial cost of child care, such as daycare centers or other licensed caretakers. That's due to a lack of funding from the state budget and an increase in demand. I'm sure you'll be covering this more. We'll talk to you more about it. Isabel, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There's more on Isabel's reporting and all of the reporting at the Democrat at scdemocratonline.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, prison doesn't just confine those behind bars. It confines families, too. We'll hear from mothers and advocates on the hidden cost of incarceration. Next on Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we'll rebroadcast a 2019 conversation with Jeff Tweedy, founder of the seminal alt-country band Wilco. He'll talk to writer George Saunders about making music and his path to recovery. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Prison is not just affecting those behind bars. It ripples outward to families left outside. After February's correctional officers' strike in New York, loved ones say they faced canceled visits, limited communication, and some of the same indignities their relatives endure inside. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke with Candace Miller, whose son is incarcerated at Fishkill, as well as advocates Tanya Krupat and of the Osborne Association and Sophia Elijah of the Alliance for Families for Justice, about what it means to navigate New York's incarceration system on both sides of the prison walls.
Entering a correctional facility as a visitor was not made to be easy. Loved ones of incarcerated individuals are forced to pass through an intensive screening process consisting of a metal detector, a canine dog, and now a body image scanner effective March 2025. But for Candace Miller, a Bronx resident who is currently 71 years old and has been routinely visiting her son at Fishkill Correctional Facility, she was met with unexpected challenges from correctional officers during a recent trip on August 2nd that ultimately resulted in her leaving the facility without a visit.
So I went through the first scanner. So the scanner went off. All those people there, I never saw them before. They were like brand new. I thought, no, you just beeped. So you have to go back through. So I went back through and they said, no, you have to take your wig off. So I said, take my wig off. Girl before me, they made her take her wig off, but they gave her the decency to go in the bathroom and take her wig off. So I took the wig off. She said, because as long as you don't clear the scanner, you cannot go through. I mean, you cannot have a visit. So I said, okay, I'll take the wig off, so I want my visit.
Although she's been told to take off her wig during past visits, Miller said in an interview with Radio Catskill that she's never been forced to do so publicly and always gone to the bathroom accompanied by a female officer when asked. But even after having to take her wig off and eventually even her hairnet, in which she had resort to wearing a plastic bag to cover her bare head, the scanner continued to beep. Confused as to what was setting the machine off, Miller, who has scoliosis, raised the possibility that...
So I said, oh, there was a correction officer standing next to me, next to the lock. I said, oh, maybe it's the pain patches I had on. Oh, why did I say that? Oh, I got something started all over again. And they said, you cannot wear no pain patches in here. You cannot wear a back... No, they said, you cannot wear that brace in here. But the brace has been cleared. I mean, I didn't try to sneak it in. I placed it through the scanner so you can clear it to let you see there was nothing in it. I just need it for support.
And Miller is not alone in her experience with officers. Sophia Elijah, former executive director of the Correctional Association of New York and founder of the Alliance of Families for Justice, a nonprofit dedicated to empowering families of incarcerated folks, explained that family members often do the time with their incarcerated loved ones but suffer in silence, which includes being subject to the same position of powerlessness that their loved ones behind bars face when visiting but also beyond.
Harassment by COs is common. It's been common for as long as I've been visiting prisons, which is over 50 years, and I'm sure it far preceded that. Family members are constantly being humiliated. Their dignity is not being recognized. I mean, similarly, their incarcerated loved ones are humiliated all the time. It is generally believed and accepted by guards that they don't have to recognize the humanity of people who are incarcerated or their family members. Now, of course, there are some guards who don't think that way, so I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but unfortunately, the general culture in the prisons is that incarcerated people and their family members have no human rights or dignity.
Miller's story comes amid the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, otherwise known as DOCS, instituting body image scanners as a step in the screening process. The scanners were conditions set by striking officers during the correctional officer strike from February of this year, who cited ongoing issues with contraband as their reason. In the past 3 years, a wave of restrictions have been put into place on families. Regular mail has to be photocopied, and any packages for inmates must come from approved vendors. But contraband has also been shown to be a major issue among correctional officers who do not have to walk through scanners to enter the facilities. The issue with the body scanners in particular is their high sensitivity, or rather invasiveness. Miller described witnessing other women crying in exasperation for being falsely accused of carrying contraband after scanners detected them wearing menstrual products, including tampons and pads. Both Elijah and Tanya Krupat, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the criminal justice reform nonprofit Osborne Association, said they've also been hearing stories of menstrual products as well as medical implants being marked as contraband and loved ones subsequently being denied their visit.
And so if I need to be graphic, I will. If a woman is wearing a sanitary napkin or a tampon, the body scanner picks that up. And what has been happening more and more frequently is if the body scanner picks that up, then the person is told that they cannot visit because the body scanner picked that up. Now, if a woman is on her menses or going through menopause, she has to wear one or more of those items. And then she's told she cannot visit. We've actually had incidents where a woman has offered to remove either the sanitary napkin or the tampon, which obviously is not desirable when you're sitting in a visit. And the guard has said, you can remove it, but you're not going to be allowed to go in.
Even after correctional officers had identified her wedding ring as the culprit for the beeping, Miller was called uncooperative and was unable to pass, leading her to walk out of the facility out of frustration. This is when she saw a state trooper, who she believed the correctional officers had called on her, walking towards the door when three officers rushed out to meet him, saying she's already left.
Some people will drive you insane in that place. The things that they do to people is just inhumane. And I said, if they're treating us this way, how are they treating our loved ones?
Following the incident, Miller did file a written complaint regarding her visit on August 2nd, which has since been forwarded to the superintendent's office of Fishkill Correctional Facility. Upon Radio Catskill's request to docs for comment on her experience, they denied that Miller was forced to take her wig off and instead voluntarily informed correctional staff that she had a wig on and removed it based on their preliminary investigation and review of video footage. They also responded that the New York State Police was not involved in any capacity during the altercation, but they did not respond to the specific allegations regarding Miller being yelled at for wearing a back brace and pain patches, nor women being turned away for wearing menstrual products. Radio Catskill was not able to independently verify the statement before airtime, but has filed a FOIL request for the video footage in question. Nonprofit organizations like Osborne Association, however, have worked to support families throughout this process. In partnership with Docs, they run 19 hospitality centers in New York State for families to mentally and physically prepare for visiting, which includes taking care of potential issues such as dress code or proper documentation beforehand. But since the correctional officer strike, visiting for maximum security facilities have remained limited to the weekends and or one day of the week, meaning longer lines for families, overcrowded conditions inside facilities, and shorter visits with loved ones. Krupat said the visiting experience has become that much more stressful for both families and correctional officers, which can then border on hostile.
The visitor experience can be incredibly stressful. I think right now there's the added stressors with staffing changes, new policies, overcrowding. So the tensions are, I imagine, even higher than normal. There isn't really time necessary for problem solving. I can imagine some officers, if you have a long line, you're more likely to just, you know, deny a visit and move on because you've got lots of people waiting than if visits are spread out over 7 days and it's not overcrowded, you can work with an individual visitor a little more and have more patience. Also, the tensions if officers aren't trained, are new to the post, overcrowding, all of these are kind of the ingredients for very stressful, even confrontational interactions.
But Elijah argues that experiences like Miller's are much deeper than just the correctional officer strike and its reverberating impacts. Instead, they are inherent to two major dynamics that underline the New York State prison system.
One is that all the power rests with the guards. All the power rests with the guards. And the people who are incarcerated and their family members are subject to the whim and abuse of power by the guards. In New York State, you have an additional dynamic. In New York State, the overwhelming majority of the prisons are located in upstate New York. And the demographics in upstate New York is generally lacking in any significant numbers of Black and brown people. The criminal justice system is racist, and a disproportionate number of Black and brown people have their lives interrupted by the criminal justice system and are incarcerated. If you visit any prison in New York State, you will find an overwhelming number of Black and Latinx people in those prisons. So you have the guards in these prisons are overwhelmingly from all white communities, and they have absolute power over incarcerated people who are overwhelmingly from Black and Latinx communities. And so you mix in racism because the guards, by and large, have had no contact with Black and brown people except in their job setting. So they don't have any level of respect, and they are dining on a daily of racism. So that combination of racism and absolute power results in further obliteration of any modicum of respect for the dignity of the humanity of the people who are incarcerated and their family members. The things that guards say and do to visitors, who are most of the time women, they wouldn't dare say to their mothers, sisters, grandmothers, aunties, or daughters.
And for Doris Chavis, a social worker living in Rochester whose oldest son has been incarcerated at Wyoming Correctional Facility for about 2 years now, this power imbalance has manifested into a culture of fear. On a visit with her daughter, Chavis recalled an officer rudely remarking on her daughter's leggings as she was passing through the metal detector and feeling at that moment that she could do nothing.
I went through first and I was getting ready to go into the scanner. And my daughter was going through the metal detector, and he said very, very rudely, "I'm not letting you in wearing those pants. You're not going in there." And it's like, she's a child. Her mother is here. I wasn't happy, but I could have spoken up and said something in a respectful manner, but it doesn't matter because they don't like to be challenged. So he would have probably, and I don't want to assume, but I'm just going to take a wild guess and say he probably would have taken me addressing him as me being disrespectful or defiant or whatever, and either A, took my visit, or B, retaliate against my son. And no family should feel like that. I should not have fear to speak up for my minor child in a respectable manner out of fear of retaliation against my loved one, whom they have the power and control over. Because even if he would have sent me home, it would have sucked. But I would have been okay. I would have came back the next week. But what if he wouldn't have sent me home, and what if later on that day, my son would have been the next Robert Brooks?
And the actual screening process is just one part of the fight loved ones have to navigate without any support from the system. Even getting to the facility in the first place is a major issue for many families. Richard Seller, a mill worker living in Lewis County whose wife has been incarcerated at Bedford Hills, said it takes about 4 hours to get to the facility from where he lives. Although he has not personally faced any harassment from officers, he described the fatigue of driving for 8 hours round trip on top of gas expenses, which makes it physically taxing for him and his three children to see their mother. For others, specifically elderly people, it can be physically impossible, meaning their loved ones miss out on these connections. But Seller said he finds a sense of powerlessness also creeping its way into the smaller moments. When docs flagged a video of his son throwing discus at a high school track meet from being sent to his wife. When items in the packages the family sends to Bedford Hills are consistently lost. When bureaucratic inefficiencies meant his family wasn't able to visit his wife on her birthday.
So Bedford, half the alphabet goes on Saturday, half the alphabet goes on Sunday, and then it flips the following weekend. Her birthday was a Saturday, so I called her counselor and got an exemption because we have to drive from so far away. We drove 4 hours down there to see her, and we walked in, and the person in visitation said, today's not her day, and I said, I have an exemption. I called the counselor, Mr. Dice, and everything should be all set, and they're like, oh, yep, let us go look. He never filed the paperwork. So we spent 8 hours on the road, over $100 in gas and tolls, and never got to see her on her birthday. She was in tears. My son was pushing me out of the visitation room because I was, I don't know if I was belligerent, but I was definitely upset and irate that, you know, all that wasted time and money.
This is despite the fact that visiting has proven to promote growth, Krupa explained. Helping maintain connection between incarcerated individuals and their families, especially for children of incarcerated parents. New York does have the proximity law, effective since 2021, that requires parents to be incarcerated as close to their minor children as possible. And a bill focused on reestablishing inmates' rights to see their families in person 7 days a week and maintain regular communication with them is currently sitting in a Senate committee.
Focus and my focus for more than 20 years professionally has specifically been on the impact on children and how important visiting is. So if you think of, you know, phone calls are important, letters are important, email is important, but visiting is the only way to speak with, see, and touch your parent. It's for younger children. There's so much of the relationship that's not verbal, even. It's the only way to be reassured that your parent is actually okay, to see them, to have important conversations. There's certain information that is just difficult to share over the phone, conversations that families need to have, decision making, whether it's related to children, moving, school, medical decisions, all kinds of things that come up that are sensitive, that people really need time.
Especially during the strike, Seller found himself suffering from anxiety attacks due to the overwhelming uncertainty of whether or not his wife was okay. Chavis described a similar fear after she had to tirelessly fight for answers after her son's lung collapsed, having only been notified of his placement at Wyoming County Hospital after another incarcerated individual had told her husband.
I don't feel like I've received any support. No. It's so many different levels of brokenness between these systems that it should. No, I can't even put it in words, but no, I literally do not. No, these systems are beyond broken. And it's sad. It's sad that there is research out there to show what could lessen our recidivism rates and the U.S. refuses to follow other countries' leads. It's sad. And that's all I can say about that.
I just spoke with families of incarcerated individuals alongside Sophia Elijah of the Alliance of Families for Justice and Tanya Krupat of the Osborne Association on the experience of incarceration from the perspective of loved ones. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Julia, for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, from loose pages to broken bindings, we'll learn the secrets of simple book fixes at home. That's next. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels. Small-batch, handmade, New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York. GrizzlyBagels.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
This Week in This American Life. When Angela's family goes on vacation, her dad plans everything. 1 year, the plan went awry.
I don't think I was particularly traumatized.
Wow, you went, like, you got hit by lightning.
Like, lightning's not personal. The lightning wasn't like, Angela, you're ugly.
When nature, fate, and the federal government mess with your plans, that's This Week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, attention book lovers, the Livingston Manor Library has a unique program this week about preserving the books you love. It's Thursday, September 4th at 6. The Library will host professional book conservator Kara Schlesinger for a hands-on presentation about book conservation and care. She'll share tips on protecting your personal library, demonstrate simple at-home repairs, and even show you how to make something called starch paste, a traditional material used in book binding and paper repair. Joining us now, Kara Schlesinger, to tell us a little bit more. Kara, good morning.
Hi, Tim. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I haven't really thought about book conservation. Can you tell folks what book conservation is and how did you get into this field?
Well, book conservation is the field that encompasses the care and preservation of books so that people can continue using them after they leave our hands and they move on to the next generations and into the future. So conservators are concerned with everything from the environmental conditions where books are stored, so temperature and humidity, to pest management. We want to make sure that books which can be food do not become food for insects or rodents. And we also do the hands-on work of stabilizing or repairing damage when that happens to books and documents that are of value. And value, of course, has lots and lots of different meanings. And from our perspective, if it's valuable to you, then it's valuable to us. And how I got into conservation was, in fact, an accident. I went to hear a lecture on the history of manuscript illumination. This was at the Center for Book Arts in New York City. And the speaker talked wonderfully about the way traditional gilding and manuscript illumination happened. And then there was a little hands-on demo at the end of the presentation where I got to gild a tiny little dot of gesso with a tiny little square of gold leaf. And I knew from that moment that I wanted to do something involving books, making books with my hands. And so I started taking classes. And after several years, I took my first book repair class, and I knew at that moment that everything I had done up to that point, all of the sewing practice and learning about book structures and making blank books and making protective boxes, that had all been practice for this repair class. And so I turned my full attention to learning about book history and book structures and how to repair and preserve them, and that's what I've been doing for the past 20 years.
And you're giving that talk and demonstration at the Livingston Manor Library tomorrow. Can you tell us what participants can expect to see and learn there?
Sure. Well, the first thing I want to do is share with people some of the key information that they need to know in order to have a safe environment for protecting their books at home. These are books that are not, unlike in a special collections library where there's a whole room or building constructed to control temperature and humidity and access to the books. The books in our homes are books that we use, that we handle, that we interact with. And so there are ways to keep those books safe even as we're interacting with them. So I'll talk a bit about what those conditions are and what people can do, practically speaking, in a home environment to keep their books safe. And we will also then talk about some of the simple things that people can do to protect their books when they're damaged. And those things are not always repair. Sometimes that means putting a protective wrapper on a book that will keep it safe, keep its broken parts together. Or if the book is degrading, we want to make sure that the leather, say, or the paper fragments don't spill all over your shelves and get all over your other books or your hands when you're reading the book. So we'll talk about ways that books can be made safe to handle and safe on the shelf. And then I will talk about some small repairs that people can do if, for example, a page is torn or a page comes out of a book. There are some ways using over-the-counter materials, as it were. There are some quote-unquote archival tapes that are made, which are not really recommended for library use, but for books in a home are very good to use and far better than something like masking tape or scotch tape, which we would, you know, turn to if we didn't know there was something better to use. But I'll also introduce starch paste.
Yeah, I alluded to that. I alluded to that at the beginning. It sounds a little unusual, but important here. What is it, and why is it such a staple in book repair and conservation?
Well, starch paste has actually been used since the first century AD, where there's a record of it being used to make papyrus. And in the West and also in the East, we traditionally use wheat starch, although for many centuries, flour itself was used to make paste. When flour gets wet, just think about when you're making bread or cookies, how sticky it is in your hands. And so people were taking advantage of that to adhere material together in order to make books. In Asia, they were also using rice starch. The reason that conservators prefer starch to flour is that the gluten in flour actually makes it much more tasty for pests. And so we find that by using starch without the gluten, it's not that it's not food anymore, but it's less yummy. It's less attractive. So we use starch and we cook it in a particular way in order to get it to the right consistency and the right stickiness. And this can also be done at home. Instead of buying a specialized wheat starch, you can use cornstarch from the store. It works just as well, and I'll demonstrate how to do that, and I will show how to repair a torn page, and I'll also be doing some small repairs on a couple of library books, and I'll show how that repair can be done on a library book as well.
And are you often surprised how some people don't realize how much craftsmanship goes into conserving books? Are you there?
Here I am. Yes.
We lost you. I don't know if you heard me, but are you often surprised about how much craftsmanship goes into conserving books?
Oh, it's a very, very complex and detailed field. It takes a lot of craftsmanship. Yeah. You need to know so much about the history of books so that when a book is broken, you know the appropriate way to address it. You need to understand the materials that were used in any given period so that you know the appropriate way to interact with those materials. And then, of course, there's the handwork. Your hands need to understand what they're doing. They need to understand how to shape and work with these materials. And sometimes materials can be fragile or brittle. Things can be very small. You're getting into some very tiny spaces. So it takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of learning to be able to understand well what a book needs. I listen to the books. I let them tell me what they need. And then I work with them to give them the best that I can with what's available to me in order to make them safe so that they can continue in their function as containers of information. We want to be able to access that information. So the craftsmanship is what helps make that possible.
What's one of the most interesting or challenging projects you've listened to or worked on in your career?
Well, one wonderful project that I got to work on was actually an early yearbook from Princeton. But all of the photographs, each page of that yearbook, it was actually a photo album, and each page was an original photograph. And many of the photographs had come out of the book. And the cover was also in pieces. There was only one sort of Texas-shaped piece of leather that had Princeton University and the date, the class that was in there. And so it was like doing detective work to look at what was left of the book to figure out what the original marbled paper that was on the end papers looked like and how the book needed to go back together, how to insert all of the detached photos back into the binding, and then to rebuild a new leather binding around the book into which I was able to set the original piece, which had some lovely gilding on it, some lovely decorated gilding. And I didn't duplicate that gilding because my job is not to make the book look as if it's original. My job is to stabilize that book and make it safe for the future, but I wanted it to harmonize with that original piece of leather. So I just added a little bit of gilding that connected the original borders to fill in what was missing, just to show that this book used to have a lovely border on it, and it used to have marbled paper that looked like this.
And now it's a new binding, but it's friendly with what the original binding used to be. And it evokes what that book was when it was first bound, while still making it safe to use and safe to handle and to move on to the future. That was a wonderful project to work on.
It's fascinating. Kara Schlesinger of, is it Fainwill Bindery? Is that correct?
Fainwill Bindery. Fainwill. Yes. Fainwill is a deliberate misspelling of the Welsh word that means my dear.
Well, that's another story. But yes, you can learn it maybe tomorrow at 6 at the Livingston Manor Library. Kara Schlesinger, a bench-trained bookbinder and book conservator who has spent years caring for rare, valuable, and beloved books. She will show folks what's possible to preserve, best practices for caring for hardcover books, new and old, tomorrow at the Livingston Manor Library. There's more information at the livingstonmanorlibrary.org website. Kara, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Tim. And if I can just note, if people would like more information, they're welcome to have a look at my website, which is carabooks.com. That's carabooks.com. And I hope to see people tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, the latest from culture reporter Valerie Manzi, a new exhibit at Catskill Art Space. We'll be back after this break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're going to spice up your life. When you have all this great produce, it's time to make some killer Mexican salsas and Korean banchan. Creative takes on produce coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Catskill Art Space is showcasing the work of artist Bonnie Richlack. The show highlights Richlack's distinctive use of wax and pigment to create textured sculptural forms that blur the line between painting and sculpture. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with the artist to talk about her creative process, the stories behind her work, and what visitors can expect when they step into Catskill Art Space Gallery.
Good morning, Bonnie Richlack, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning to you, and I'm honored to be able to speak to the community in the Catskills.
Well, the Catskill community is very lucky to have the Catskill Art Space right here in Livingston Manor, and you are one of the exhibitors. Your exhibit runs through to October 25th, and
yes,
the museum is open Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And for more information, folks can go to info@catskillartspace.org or just go to the website. So, Bonnie, your exhibit and those of Jeff Christensen and Heidi Schlechter were a big success on Saturday. Lots of folks.
It seems so. There were lots of people there, and many people from New York City, which I was really happy and surprised to see.
And your show, we're going to start with its title.
Don't Overplay It, Sugar.
So what is that about?
I was looking for a title, and the work had been in my studio. Most of the work was made in 2024, so I've had a long time to deliberate it. And I listened to music all the time, mostly jazz. And I can't even tell you what song I heard it in, but I loved the phrase, don't overplay it, sugar. And I thought, that's exactly what I should think about. don't take it too seriously in terms of how all of it was weighing on me. It also had a very funny, kind of ironic tone to it, and I latched onto it.
The show is mainly encaustics.
And cast wax.
And can you explain to those of us who might not be familiar with encaustics, give us a little bit of a background?
Of course. In fact, I teach encaustic, too, and I explain this to a lot of people who take the class and don't know what it is either. It is painting with hot wax, and it's an ancient technique that was used by the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Romans to decorate various things, including their boats, to waterproof columns and all sorts of things. They could decorate with it and waterproof at the same time. But then it fell out of favor over the centuries, and it was really just maintained a little bit by Byzantine or Russian icons, and then pretty much disappeared. There were some artists in the Renaissance who tried to use it, but you have to apply it horizontally. As you imagine, hot wax would drip, and it's very difficult to control. So it wasn't really rediscovered until people like Jasper Johns and others, and the electric, heaters, and it's very, very old, but it's...
And it's a very complex and tedious technique, I would imagine.
It's tedious. It's actually simple in that I basically use the hot plate, pins to melt the wax, and I use beeswax primarily, which is somewhat clear, and then I add a little pigment to it, and then apply it to whatever surface I'm applying it to. But the tedious part is that when you apply it, you then have to heat it again, scrape it, and put on another layer. And that's how you build up the surfaces and the deep, deep sensual images that you get.
The colors and the textures that you've achieved and the shapes are really quite astonishing.
Yes. Well, they're circular in this case, but I've been applying hot wax to all sorts of things, wood for a very long time, and vertical structures, square structures, and I've also been casting a lot of the wax too, which I do in basically the same way. I melt big vats of wax and add pigment to it. And in some cases, I know this sounds very strange, I sweep up whatever's on my studio floor, which is, dead insects and dirt and other sorts of things, and I sweep it into the melting wax. And then I'll pour it into molds, big circles, big rectangular shapes, and then carve with hot tools into them. So one of the pieces that you saw on the floor there,
yes,
the big drain with the mirror, that's one. It was cast as one big circle, and then I carved the shapes out and melted to make it look like a drain. What can I say? I really enjoy using the material. I've been using it since 1981, and I'm always astonished by what it can do.
And the beautiful colors that you were able to capture. The other thing I found when I walked in there was it was as if they cried out to be touched.
Oh, yes. And I hate to say it, but yes, one could touch it. I don't encourage it, but it's not going to destroy the surface. It very sensual material. And it also, with the beeswax, smells quite wonderful too. But what I do with the circles, and in this case, I use stretched fabric, and it's upholstery fabric for the most part. And I never am quite sure how the wax will be absorbed into the fabric, and that can change everything. So what I do is I let one area be revealed, whether it's the edge or the center, and everything around it, around the center, is covered in encaustic, whether colored or not. And I'm revealing what the fabric is really, what it really looks like underneath the encaustic. So, but again, I never am sure how the wax will be absorbed. And that adds to the texture and also the color, because it could be darker, it could be lighter, depending on the fabric.
The other thing I was struck by was the steeliness of the steel and the beautiful sensual texture of the beeswax. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to combine those two together?
Yes. Well, for many years now, I've been using this drain motif, and drain conjures water and effluence and things that go down the drain. The drain at the bottom of the swimming pool, the feared drain. But I do think, even as a child, when you'd swim in somebody's swimming pool, we'd play the game of the penny. It was always scary if it was near the drain and you had to pick it up. So I guess there's that fear, that mystery, that intrigues me. And so that brings up the water again. And with water, plumbing devices, accessories, whether it's the drain. And that contrast is a dichotomy of sorts, the sensual and the beautiful, and combination of the two, I think really it's a big part of what I am trying to achieve, I think, whether it comes across or not. But those are the elements that really I use a lot, that difference between the metal and the hardness, the urban, the industrial, contrasted with the sensual and the soft and the fabric. I mean, there was a long time I was using terry cloth, and I thought it was just such an interesting fabric because it had so many associations. It could be wet, like in a gym, and smelly and used, or it could be cuddly and soft. So it's sort of the same notion, if I'm making myself understood at all.
Well, you are. You're talking about your process and the things that intrigue you. So
yes,
it's wonderful to have some of that insight. And before we have to conclude, I'd just like you to talk a little bit about catalog that you have available at Catskill Art Space.
Well, they were all taken. So I don't know if they're there anymore. I can send more up to the center. But it was something that I always wanted to do. As I said, this is a body of work that I produced pretty much in all in 2004. There's one floor piece that I finished this year. But I, as a body of work, I really wanted to see it all under one cover. And as we know, exhibitions come and go, and this was something I felt really I should do, not only in terms, well, for myself. I really wanted to, it's a way of closing the door on something, because I don't think I'm going to be doing any more of this particular kind of circle. The drain motif, I cannot suppress that. It seems to come up wherever I turn. Perhaps the Catskill Art Center, I can send them the PDF of it. People can get it that way. My dear friend, graphic designer, Eileen Boxer, designed it, and she's just an amazing person. All I do is give her the photographs and the essays, and she channels the whole thing. It's very beautiful.
Bonnie, this has been a wonderful conversation with you.
Yes.
And
thank you.
Again, I would like to share with the audience that's the Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, New York. And the show is up until October 25th, along with Jeff Christensen's show and Heidi Schlechter's show. All of you did a wonderful job. The work is certainly waiting to be seen by all of us.
Well, I hope people do turn out for it. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that interview. That's about it for this edition of Radio Catskill. Reminder, the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee celebrates Radio Catskill's 35th anniversary. That's coming up September 13th at the Lou Beach Community Center there on Shin Creek Road. Tickets $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. And you'll get to hear some live music from Callison, Lally and the Pops, and a DJ set from Jason Tuga, plus beer available for purchase from our friends at Catskill Brewery. Come on out, help support us. The 13th at the Lou Beach Community House, a summer jubilee celebrating our 35th anniversary. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Celebrate 35 years of Radio Catskill at the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee. Join us on Saturday, September 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. for live music from Kala Sun and Lolly and the Pops and a DJ set by the Mixtape's Jason Dugoff, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets are $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. More information at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Sunny and nice today with a high of 73. Tomorrow, breezy in the afternoon with some rain entering the forecast tomorrow night and lasting through a late Saturday. Rain on Friday with thunderstorms expected on Saturday. High on Sunday, though, not as warm, 66, partly sunny.